Morning, everyone.
Morning.
It's Friday. It's a beautiful day out there as well. Before we actually begin our oral arguments, Judge Bay and I would just like to thank and acknowledge District Judge Edelman, who's visiting with us from the Eastern District of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. We're very pleased to have him with us for a few days, and we're very grateful. Thank you very much.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, our first case that's listed on the calendar is Johnson versus Velasquez, and that's been submitted on the briefs and record. So our actual first case for oral argument this morning is Beament, I believe, versus Cox, number 19-15495. Go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jeffrey Dickerson from Reno, Nevada, appearing on behalf of the appellant, who was the plaintiff below, Baron Beament. You pronounced it correctly, Your Honor.
Thank you.
This is a disability discrimination case involving all three facets of the Disability Act, meaning disability discrimination, failure to accommodate a disability, and retaliation for asserting rights under the Act. I'd like to get right to it. The briefing has been handled with respect to the main issues in the case. I think the remnants of that briefing are as follows. Beginning first with the disability issue, which flows to each of the three claims. In other words, if we don't get off the ground with a disability, we don't have a claim. And if all we have is a regarded as theory, the failure to accommodate claim goes away because that's not a viable claim with the regarded as theory. So the state argues that we haven't shown a disability because we've only produced medical records of a one-time stomach incident that resolved in 5 days. And it cites some case law with respect to that. The head case that we cite is still good law as to the proposition that we've cited it for, which is that medical evidence is not necessary in order to establish a disability, an actual disability under the ADA or the Rehabilitation Act.
But head involved bipolar. Now the diagnosis. What was the diagnosis of Mr. Beament?
The diagnosis of Mr. Beament on that one occasion was a stomach disorder of some kind. And
was he given Cipro?
Well, that's a good question. I don't remember that, but I do remember that I think the medical record displays that there was a differential diagnosis as to the cause being either age or diverticulitis. Okay. But my point is, under the head case, putting that medical record aside, for what it's worth, as I just indicated, Baron Beament, the plaintiff himself under the head case, can't testify as to what he knows about his disability and what he knows about the impact that disability has or that physical impairment has upon his ability to perform his daily life activities. And he testified, or at least it's in the record, during the pre-disciplinary hearing, which was before he was suspended, which is an adverse action in this case, he indicated to the pre-disciplinary hearing officer, and we have the transcript in the record of this, that he has pockets in his intestines and that they're painful, and when they are painful, he has to flush his guts out, and when that happens, he becomes incontinent for a few days, and then he feels better. That is, I would submit, just as if somebody says, my knee hurts, I think I broke it, that's good to go under the Ninth Circuit precedent. So is saying, I've got pockets in my intestines, because how would he know that unless a doctor had told him that? He doesn't have a way to look inside his intestines. And how would he know that he has to flush to take care of that? A doctor must have told him that. So what he's doing, I think, is a reasonable inference, is he's repeating what he learned, and it's not hearsay because it's for the purpose of diagnosis and treatment.
Does it matter if he's repeating it, or what if that's just his own statement? Does that get you past the summary judgment?
Well, it's his understanding.
And is that enough, regardless of where it might have come from?
I think the specificity of it, they say this is conclusory stuff, and that's pretty specific to say he's got pockets in his intestines, Your Honor, and to say that he needs to flush them to get the condition resolved. So I would maintain that that is enough to show that he has an impairment, and then he can further testify under the head case and all other case law what impact that impairment has upon him. And he's testified to that. The state says that the testimony is conclusory in nature, but it's not conclusory. He's testified that he has pain, abdominal pain, and it's debilitating, that he has to follow the regimen of flushing out his intestines. He calls it flushing out his guts. And when he does that, he feels better in a few days. The inference there is that he must not have felt better before he did that, and he took a few days to feel better after that. So there's that going on when this is an active condition. The state argues that, well, it's just a temporary condition. It's not a permanent condition, and therefore it doesn't constitute a disability, but the Americans with Disabilities Act amendments of 2008 changed that. And so if it's a recurring or dormant type of thing, you look at it when it's active to see whether it's substantially limiting daily life activities. And I would maintain that what I've just indicated in terms of the plaintiff's testimony satisfies that.
So the district court said the plaintiff's testimony was just insufficient to establish an impairment.
But
she said it was too self-serving.
Well, the self-serving idea, Your Honor, is every piece of evidence that a lawyer proffers is self-serving. I mean, the United States versus Sherman, a 1999 case that Your Honors are probably familiar with because it addresses this issue and it's been cited regularly since, that declarations oftentimes will be self-serving, and properly so, because otherwise there would be no point in a party submitting them. In most cases, consequently, quote, then an affidavit is self-serving, bears on its credibility, not on its cognizability for purposes of establishing a genuine issue of material fact. And that's 199 Fed 3rd, Penn site 1104.
I guess, in other words, your point is, even if this is not sort of on the papers, it appears to be the strongest case, it's probably enough to get by summary judgment.
That's my point.
On the first issue.
Yeah, especially under head with respect to the first
issue. The district
issue.
Court didn't go beyond the first issue of your prima facie case.
That's right. So, I guess the question lingers as to what, if you find that the district court should be reversed on that one issue, should it remand for further findings or whatever, or is it clear from the record in this case that there are genuine issues of material fact remaining for trial on everything else?
So what about the as-regarded claim?
With respect to the as-regarded claim, again, Mr. Beeman has testified as to his interactions with his chain of command with respect to this condition, that he kept Warden Mattis, who's the head guy at that facility, the Warm Springs Correctional Center, they talked about this condition. They knew that he had bleeding. They knew that he'd been hospitalized. They knew that when it happened, he had to flush his pockets out.
Who's they?
This would be Warden Mattis. This would be Greg Smith. This would be, I think, on the first part of our page of our brief under the argument section, I talk about four or five people that Mr. Beeman specifically referred to. And not only that, but I referred to some of the testimony of them themselves, that they were aware that he had some kind of problems. The state's argument is that, well, they didn't have the here is their testimony, that they didn't know he had any specific intestinal problems.
Is their knowledge enough, or do they have to somehow have some sense that some belief in the genuineness of it?
Well, I don't see any evidence that there's a reason to doubt what he said, and that there was some effort, including extending him an offer for FMLA leave. They must have thought there might be a serious health condition behind it, and they must have had a reason as an employer to proffer that to him. So I think there's enough evidence in the record for a reasonable juror to infer that they had adequate knowledge, Your Honor.
And on the retaliation claim, what's the protected activity? And what's the adverse action?
The protected activity is the they claim that without specifically recognizing that leave can be a reasonable accommodation under the Nunez case and progeny. So that's a given. Did he request leave? And they say, no, there's no evidence that he did. But at ER 84 and ER 104 and 105, we specifically cited to parts of the record where he indicates, and I would suggest the court read that carefully, because they kind of say that he just tossed it to the paperwork on the FMLA to the wayside. I disagree with that reading of that particular.
As I understand the record, he never complied with their request.
He sought the FMLA.
They asked him for a doctor's note.
Well, they wanted the certification paperwork.
Right.
Yeah, and so they sent that to him. It says 15 days, get it back to us, and he didn't do that.
He didn't do it, right?
Right, but he says he.
So that's protected activity?
He testified that he didn't know about.
Well, let's answer my question: is that protected activity?
The protected activity is the initiation of the interactive process.
I don't quite follow that statement.
Let me explain. Okay.
He said that the protective activity was taking the leave.
The protected activity surrounded the leave issue. And in order to get to the leave issue, there was an interactive process they began going through. He requested FMLA paperwork, and they sent it to him. He didn't fill it out according to their deadline, but his testimony is, I think page 104 and 105 of the excerpts, that he intended to fill that out the next time he got sick. So he didn't shut down the process. They did, is our position. In other words, it's our position that from that mixed question, those mixed facts, a reasonable juror could conclude that they should have kept the door open for him.
What's the adverse action?
Well, the adverse action would include shutting the door to the FMLA leave without discussing with them what the problem was and getting it back on time. The suspension is an adverse action because during the predisciplinary hearing process that led to the final decision to impose that, he specifically disclosed the problems that we've discussed in terms of his condition and how it impaired him.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Kevin Pick on behalf of the State of Nevada and Department of Corrections. Similar to Mr. Beeman's counsel, Your Honors, the place I'd like to begin is on one of the common elements to all three claims, and that's the existence of a qualifying disability. Now, after discussing the existence of a disability, I'd like to use my remaining time to move on to the other essential elements of plaintiff's claims. As Mr. Dickerson noted, Your Honors, the Rehabilitation Act looks to the ADA definition of disability, and there's three types. The second type is a record of impairment. That's not being argued in this case. The first type of ADA disability is a physical impairment that substantially limits major life activities. And we'd like to emphasize, as we did in the briefs, Your Honor, that after 7.5 years of litigation, the plaintiff in this case has not and cannot cite an actual physical impairment in this case. Plaintiff in his briefing relies on the term intestinal problem, which is created by the plaintiff and diagnosed by himself. Plaintiff cites the Head versus Glacier case and argues that his testimony alone can establish the existence of a physical impairment. However, as Your Honor mentioned, in Head, the plaintiff already had a diagnosed physical impairment that was diagnosed by a psychologist, and that was depression and bipolar disorder. And Head merely instructs that a plaintiff can use his own testimony if that's adequate, to testify as to the effects on his activities of daily living. Nowhere does Head say that a lay witness has the power to diagnose their own physical impairment, and that'd be contrary to long-established Ninth Circuit case law that lay witnesses are not competent to testify as to the existence of a physical illness.
Didn't he say he was diagnosed with intestinal problems which interfered with intestinal functioning?
To the extent that's correct, Your Honor, he was diagnosed with 1 to 2 weeks of unspecified abdominal pain in June of 2011. That's the only medical evidence in the record of that.
Isn't that enough?
It doesn't even... No, Your Honor, I don't think it is, and that's under the standard...
But that's why I can't use that and his testimony.
Well, Your Honor, he never even connects.
Put them together. It may not be, like I said, it may not be the strongest case, but why doesn't it at least get by summary judgment?
Well, Your Honor, he never even connects, and there's no evidence to connect these other incidents that are alleged, which on page 2 of the opening brief largely takes testimony, secondhand testimony, out of context. But there's no evidence to connect this to this 1 to 2 weeks of unspecified abdominal pain. And under the Sanders case, temporary injuries or illnesses with minimal residual side effects are not the basis for a sustainable claim under the ADA.
But then he says he talks about having to go to the bathroom every 5 minutes. I mean, can't we just in sort of common sense inference infer that that's connected to his intestinal problem?
Well, I think, Your Honor, the only evidence of that would be Mr. Beeman's own speculation, which I don't think is sufficient.
Well,
you can't. Well, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, why is that speculation? He's testifying to his condition.
Well, that condition's never been diagnosed. It's 1 to 2 weeks of abdominal
pain. But
why
can't he testify as to how, you know, what problems he has?
Well, I think you can do that, is to testify as to how a diagnosed condition, at least as Head instructs, how it affects your activities of daily living. Because, Your Honors, it makes complete sense to be able to do that because you're the person witnessing what is happening on a daily basis. But Mr. Beeman's not competent, as Your Honor spoke about, to look inside of himself and say that this is an intestinal problem. Saying I have an intestinal problem is like saying I have a chest problem or a head problem. It's just not specific enough to even come close to evidence of an actual impairment in the case, which is what the statute requires.
Well, his description of an intestinal problem says that this causes him these problems every 5 minutes, right? So he has described in specific detail how his intestinal problem affects him, has he not?
As to the intestinal problems, which is, again, something that he diagnosed himself and is attributing to that, again, there's no medical evidence in the record to connect the 1 to 2 weeks of unspecified abdominal pain that resolved with antibiotics to this general nebulous intestinal problem issue, which, again, is self-diagnosed and a self-created term.
So the district court used this term self-serving as if somehow that discredited the statements, and opposing counsel said that proffers are self-serving. So what's your response to that?
Your Honor, I think it goes to the fact that, you know, all evidence proffered is self-serving, but the question is whether it's conclusory and adequate, and that's the test under Head, is whether adequate evidence was presented to get around.
Well, it looks like she gave it no weight.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I said it looks like she gave it no weight. In other words, she sort of didn't find it very credible.
She certainly did not find it credible,
well,
Your Honor.
Well, on a summary judgment, you can't judge credibility.
Well, at least under the Head case, there is a finding of adequacy in order to determine whether actual medical evidence, comparative medical evidence, is needed. And that's a legal question that was at least put to the court in the Head as the adequacy of the evidence, and she found that it was not adequate.
What's your standard for adequacy?
Well, I think, Your Honor, at least as opposed to this case, there's no evidence of a diagnosed medical condition. There's no evidence of how often these symptoms arose, the duration of the symptoms, or the severity of the symptoms. And again, there's nothing to connect. There's no medical evidence or any evidence besides Mr. Beeman's own testimony to connect any other event he's describing to this 1 to 2 weeks of abdominal pain that his doctor prescribed antibiotics for and resolved after a week and a half. So, but Your Honors, even if we had a diagnosed physical impairment in this case, and even if Mr. Beeman did provide evidence of the substantial effect, he still has not provided any direct or circumstantial evidence of causation in this case, which is
causation
again,
of what?
Causation, Your Honor, is the final is this.
I know what causation, but
yes,
causation of what?
That some sort of harm or discriminatory harm was caused because of this disability.
The district court didn't address that issue.
No, Your Honor, they didn't get to it because they didn't find that he was disabled in the first place.
They didn't find a physical impairment.
Yes, Your Honor, and they didn't find evidence of a substantial limitation either. But it's at least been our position from the beginning that there is no evidence in the record of causation, whether direct or circumstantial. And I think it's important to point out, Your Honors, that as far as taking leave is a protected activity, The plaintiffs in this case have never even cited a single date that Mr. Beament took leave because of any intestinal problem, whether diagnosed or self-diagnosed. And so I do think, Your Honors, that the excerpt, the record in this case, demonstrates a complete lack of any evidence as to causation.
What you're asking us to do is to affirm summary judgment on an issue that was not decided by the district court.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's within the court's power to do that, right. But I think if it did get to that point, I certainly wouldn't agree that there's a disability in this case. The evidence doesn't dictate that. I don't think there's adequate evidence under the Hegg case of a substantial limitation either. But even if we hypothetically allowed for that, there's not sufficient evidence to allow this case to move past the summary judgment phase.
How about the as-regarded claim?
Your Honor, the regarded as claim is interesting because...
Did the district court apply the correct standard?
I think they did, Your Honor. But if looking at the law as applied to that claim, Mr. Beament's statutorily barred because the only evidence is transitory and minor, which the ADA definition specifically takes out of the regarded as definition of disability and says that it shall not apply to impairments that are transitory and minor. Transitory and minor is 6 months or less. And as we've heard this morning, the only evidence we have on timing is that it happened for 1 to 2 weeks, which is less than 6 months. So Mr. Beament's statutorily barred. But even if we disregarded that statutory bar on asserting the regarded as prong here, there's no evidence that NDOC treated this individual as having a disability, which is certainly is having some sort of vague knowledge of some vague condition is not evidence of that NDOC treated this individual as having a disability, and there's no evidence to that effect.
Didn't they say, this Peabody, didn't he say that he knew that the plaintiff had an issue with his stomach, and the warden testified some long-term intestinal problem? I mean, isn't that knowledge?
Your Honor, I think what that points out is the fact that how vague this is and the lack of evidence is because no one even knew if this individual had an intestinal problem or a stomach problem or what the issue was. And I'd encourage Your Honor to look at the specific excerpt to record on what those individuals knew. The opening brief argues that Warden Mattis had some very definite knowledge. That's certainly not true, and that's on excerpts of record page 67, that he didn't know, he had no idea what was going on with this individual except some nebulous concept that there might be some problem that he didn't know about. Your Honors, with my couple seconds remaining here, I'd like to point out in the failure to accommodate claim, the second and third elements of that claim were NDOC raised a lack of evidence on summary judgment as those claims. The plaintiff has never addressed those claims either before the district court or this court, and therefore
well, the under- district court never got to it.
They never got to it, Your
because
Honor.
Because the failure to accommodate claim is tied to the, you know, whether he has an impairment or not.
You're
if he doesn't
right.
have an impairment, there's no need to accommodate.
You're right, Your Honor, but the fact
that's what the district court said, I think, in a footnote.
You're correct, Your Honor. The plaintiff still had the requirement under Rule 56 to rebut.
I'll give you a
judgment.
Minute just to address the retaliation claim.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's two protected activities that are argued here. I didn't hear the first one today, or the second one, I guess, is the filing of the lawsuit. And as the district court noted, Your Honors, the filing of the lawsuit's not pled anywhere in the First Amendment
right.
complaint. And it just doesn't work timing-wise because the lawsuit was filed after all the adverse employment actions that are alleged in the complaint. Now, whether taking leave is a protected activity, merely taking leave is not a protected activity, Your Honor, and the district court was correct that taking leave without requesting leave as a form of accommodation is not a protected activity. And it makes sense because otherwise any time someone ever took sick leave, it'd be a protected activity under the ADA. But even if taking sick leave was a protected activity, plaintiff again hasn't identified a single date that he did that in this case with respect to this abdominal issue. And plaintiff's intestinal problems, at least what we submit, do not arise to the level of a disability. So any leave taken regarding that is also not a protected activity. And thank you, Your Honor, for giving me a couple extra seconds, but I'd just like to say there's also a complete lack of causation as to this final element. So the plaintiff's had 7.5 years to obtain evidence as disability, protected activity, whether reasonable accommodation was required or possible, and causation. And in that time, the plaintiff has failed to demonstrate any genuine issue of material facts as to his evidence. Therefore, we'd like to ask the court to affirm
okay.
summary judgment. Thank
All
you,
right,
Your Honor.
Thank you. You can have 1 minute for rebuttal.
I think just one point, Your Honor, and that is that there is no evidence of any linkage between the impairment and any adverse employment action. And the pre-disciplinary hearing transcript shows that in explaining why he was gone for those days that he's going to be suspended for, he's explained to the pre-disciplinary hearing officer that he's got these problems that we've already gone over three times. So that would just point the court in that direction. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. That matter is submitted at this time.